Brown with What's at Stake. Stay tuned.
Is Trump's threat to attack Venezuela about stopping the alleged narco drug trafficking or merely a ruse to seize the largest oil reserves in the world? Investigative journalist Charlotte Dennett, author of Follow the Pipelines, weighs in. And prisons designed to incarcerate youth are shrinking significantly across America. Award-winning author Nell Bernstein explains why, how, and who accomplished it. Good morning. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President Trump said recently he's spoken with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro while simultaneously building up a significant military force in the region and issuing a blunt warning on social media that the airspace above and surrounding Venezuela should be closed in its entirety. Clearly a signal to U.S. allies that something is moving behind the scenes. Trump also issued Maduro an ultimatum: step down voluntarily or military force will be on the table. Trump's administration insists repeatedly that any action taken would be as part of what he described as an anti-drug campaign against the cartels his administration has designated as terror groups. Trump's State Department has designated Maduro himself as a terrorist. But Colombian President Gustavo Petro claimed this week that the U.S. military intervention in Venezuela is primarily a quest for oil, not a war on drugs. Petro said that oil is, quote, at the heart of the matter, end quote, regarding U.S. strikes on drug boats in international waters and threats to overthrow the Venezuelan president. That's a negotiation about oil, he said. I believe that is Trump's logic, he said to a CNN interview on Thursday. He's not thinking about the democratization of Venezuela, let alone the narco trafficking. In fact, Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, with over 300 billion barrels. Investigative journalist and attorney and author of Follow the Pipelines, Charlotte Dennett, is our guest once again this morning on What's at Stake. Charlotte is the daughter of the late Daniel C. Dennett, a U.S. master spy to the Middle East, who was mysteriously killed in a plane crash while on mission in Ethiopia in 1947. Welcome back to What's at Stake, Charlotte Dennett.
Hey, it's wonderful to be back with you, Verna. Mm-hmm. Nice summation you just gave.
Thank you. So, Charlotte, in your book, there's mention of the great game for oil, and it's defined as, quote, one of civilization's dirty secrets, except that it is well known by leaders, including presidents, dictators, economic advisors, oil company executives, and some intrepid spies and journalists. You are indeed an intrepid journalist, Charlotte, and an attorney. So does President Trump play the great game for oil, and how would you describe his role in it?
Well, Trump is like breaking all the rules. Because usually the great game for oil is done covertly by players who have had over a century of learning about how to play the game, how to keep it concealed from the public, and how to achieve the desired end, which is often regime change. And Trump is showing his abysmal ignorance once again. I mean, you don't go bullying Latin America. You just don't do that. One of the responses from President Maduro was that he's trying to impose colonialism on Latin America. And all he has to do is say that, and it's going to inflame a large percentage of the population, not only in Venezuela, but obviously in Colombia. And also, I would say Brazil. I mean, they're all super sensitive to the big bully of the North, once again, trying to invade their country, take over, privatize the oil industry, which had been nationalized under President Chavez. And that's the game now. And yes, he's being quite transparent about it. The thing is, his pretext is so shaky. I'm seeing it unraveling before our very eyes. And I guess he thinks because of the Supreme Court ruling that he can do anything he wants, it's just unleashed him in all of his ridiculous maneuvers. So we're seeing a fight back. And I think that the admiral that he's essentially putting the onus on as the person who orchestrated the second hit on those boats is going to be testifying tomorrow. That should be really interesting to find out what's going on. But, you know, he got rid of the lawyers in the Justice Department who warned him about illegal acts. And so now he's just being blatantly illegal, and now he's been tagged with a crime,
but
namely
so
a
far,
war crime.
Mm-hmm. Well, so far it seems that he is able to do whatever he wants. The Congress that was supposed to be, you know, a mechanism to be a check and balance for the president, the Republican-led Congress at this point seems unable or unwilling to provide any balances, checks and balances to this president. So he is doing things that many experts deem to be illegal, including the second strike on the survivors. Two survivors were apparently clinging to the side of that boat, and they deemed them as a threat, and therefore they shot and killed them. And it's been said that it's illegal to actually kill individuals during either, you know, during war or when during a time like this. So as it relates to Venezuela, the Trump administration insists its intent is to stop illegal drug trafficking in the U.S. Trump says every boat they destroy represents saving 25,000 Americans from drug overdoses. But John Hopkins health policy expert Aileen Kennedy Hendricks says, quote, "We don't have any method I'm aware of for translating drug seizure data into any measure of overdoses averted," end quote. So is Trump just making that up, Charlotte?
I'm sorry, I just got a phone call. Ask the question again. I'm sorry, got interrupted.
Is Trump basically just making up this business about 25,000 Americans are saved from drug overdoses every time they blow up one of those Venezuelan ships?
It sounds like he's creating facts to support his ridiculous pretext for invading and doing regime change in Venezuela. I can't say I'm not an authority on that, but The worst part, the total hypocrisy, is the fact that he just pardoned the former president of Honduras, who was convicted for drug trafficking by the U.S., major drug trafficking. So, you know, please give us a break. I mean,
Where's the conviction to stopping and dealing with drug traffickers?
Well, really? I mean, if you're going to pardon one of the biggest drug traffickers from Latin America, it's ridiculous. So, he's going to try. The fact that the military is so concerned, as they rightly should be, there's another factor here. You know, he's a massive, huge military presence. He hoped that would scare Maduro to step down. He even offered to give him safe passage out of the country. And you don't do that to a nationalist, which Maduro is. But I don't know, it's just, it would cause great havoc in Latin America. I'm also the co-author of a book about Latin America, titled Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon. Nelson Rockefeller and Evangelism in the Age of Oil, and it's a whole exploration of how the U.S. built up an empire in Latin America, using Nelson Rockefeller as the spearhead, because he had vast holdings. His family, the Rockefeller family, had vast holdings in Venezuela. So, and what our book chronicles is the efforts of major corporations, key among them oil, but not just oil, ranching, agribusiness, and so on, to penetrate Latin America, to get rid of the Germans during World War II, and to build up American influence in the area. And the methods that they use, it's well known. It's well known in Latin America. I mean, coups were done in Brazil alone. Both Rockefeller and his associate, Adolf Burley, who was at one point the ambassador to Brazil, they were behind a coup that removed the President Vargas. That was in 1945. And then again in 64, a coup, a CIA-sponsored coup that got rid of, Goulart. President Goulart. And what was the point? It was to get the resources. That's the whole point.
And always about the oil. Always about the oil.
Well, you know, it's not always about the oil, but often, most often about oil. And there was oil. Nelson Rockefeller had a dream, a shining dream of developing the Amazon. Thing is, if you get American troops set in there, there's vast areas of jungle in Venezuela, and obviously the Amazonian countries. It's not just Brazil. And as my husband and partner was observing to me the other day, this could be Vietnam all over again. You get those troops in that unfamiliar territory. No, this is not a good idea. Mm. And it may be another reason for the pushback that you're seeing, that you can't have troops going into an area that is going to be in violation of the law. You can't do that. I think that's why there's so much. They see the folly of this whole thing. But Trump is totally beholden to big oil more than any other. That's how he's raised money for his donations. And so he's going to do whatever it takes. You know, he's Mr. Drill Baby Drill. Venezuela does have the largest reserves of oil. The thing is, a lot of them aren't exported right now because it's been heavily sanctioned under questionable claims, so that it has not been able to export the oil that it has. But the whole idea is to privatize the oil industry. And, you know, the woman that was chosen as the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize very recently was a leader of the opposition to Maduro. Her name was Machado. She was a resistance person. And she's totally doing whatever it takes to help Trump get control of Venezuelan oil. I mean, she says it's a great opportunity. We're going to open up markets. We're going to kick the government from the oil sector. We're going to privatize all our industry. So she gets the Nobel Peace Prize instead of him. And she's doing his bidding. She's still doing his bidding.
You know, well, now tell us, Charlotte, what would it look like? What impact would that have on the American consumer if, for example, Trump were to somehow create regime change and take control of the oil reserves in Venezuela?
Well, how would it make? This much I can say, that what is behind a lot of this drill baby drill is the fact that AI is needing massive amounts of natural gas, which is, of course, you drill for oil, you drill for gas, right? It's natural gas that's going to be powering AI data centers. So if Trump were to able to control the oil of Venezuela, well, that then he'd get more gas, and then that would support all these new tech companies that are building like crazy these data centers. So this is why you're seeing an undermining of all the protections that have been put in place. Not enough, but you know, there's been some progress. This is why Trump withdrew from the Paris Climate Accords and did not appear, did not have any representation at the COP30 meetings on climate that just ended in Brazil, in Belém, Brazil. So the impact on the consumer, for one thing, is going to be less protection if from tropical storms. And I was reading that even people in Venezuela, are a lot of them are not too keen on super developing the oil sector. They want to see alternative energy being pursued. So we'll see what happens. But it's not going to be good for the American consumer, and it's not going to be good for our soldiers, for sure.
Okay. Well, now you're an attorney. So is there any legal action that U.S. Cities or citizens could take to sort of stay the administration's actions before they attack Venezuela?
Well, I think it's members of Congress. Actually, there's a bipartisan effort now involving both Republicans and Democrats to get to the bottom of this, the pretext that is shooting those boats and doing the killing of the two survivors. So I think that's the best way. Once we get more information, then I think, well, it depends on what's discovered. The admiral is going to be, Bradley, I believe his name is, he's going to be questioned tomorrow. And once we know who was really behind doing that second set of killing and the circumstances, that'll give more power to people if they want to demonstrate. I mean, it's important to demonstrate based on the facts, right?
Okay.
So
yes.
Let's see what happens tomorrow.
Okay. So now let's switch to Gaza, where another several billion barrels of oil exist. We're made to believe that the genocide of the Palestinian people there is because of crimes committed by the Hamas against the Israelis, and indeed people were killed and hostages were taken. But is there an unspoken agenda at play in Gaza, Charlotte?
Yes, there is. Yeah, and it often doesn't get mentioned. And one of the reasons that I focus so much on oil and pipelines is because you don't hear about it a lot. I mean, you do, you talk about it, but a lot of the mainstream doesn't. Members of Congress don't. And that's because the oil lobby is incredibly powerful, and it's flooded Congress with donations. So you don't hear members of Congress talking about the oil connection to any of these conflicts. What is the oil connection to Gaza? Very simple. Starting in 2000, there's a large reserves of oil and natural gas found off the coast of Gaza. And in 2010, even more deposits of oil and natural gas off the coast of Israel, worth approximately, in total, $500 billion. So during this whole decade, between 2000 and 2010, Benjamin Netanyahu, first as finance minister, later as prime minister, has been angling to keep the oil out of the hands of the Gazans. And his generals have argued that it's not going to benefit them. It's just going to go into feeding terrorism, which is a sort of a traditional argument used when you want to discredit a group that's, frankly, has the right to protest its occupation. That's that in international law. You have the right to protest occupation. You don't hear that very much. There's just been so much misinformation over decades about the Middle East and about those who don't want colonialism or imperialism. And it's a 70-year war. That's one thing I learned investigating the death of my father.
Mm.
So he wants to build an energy corridor. I just wanted to add that.
Thank you.
Netanyahu wants to exploit the oil and natural gas off the coast, the Mediterranean coast, and ship it up to Europe, which is now more energy insecure since the war in Ukraine. They're all related, and they're all proxy wars for oil.
Okay. Now, unbeknownst to many, oil was at the heart of the 1921 massacre of Black Wall Street. Tulsa, Oklahoma had just been declared the oil capital of the world, and during Trump's first campaign for president, he selected Tulsa to hold a rally on Juneteenth Day of all days, but public pressure forced him to change the date. Tell us more about that. You've written about that, Charlotte.
I heard there was this whole uproar about he was going to have his big campaign rally right next to what is called Black Wall Street. And it was going to be on Juneteenth, which was the celebration of the end of slavery. And being the racist that he is, this was not a popular idea. And he did change the date to the next day. But it got me wondering, what the heck, what's this all about? So then I started investigating, and I found out that he was angling to get big donations from some of the Tulsa oil men. But now, what was this Black Wall Street? Well, it turns out that around the turn of the century into the early 1920, oil became big in Oklahoma, and there were former slaves and servants who sat on, they were from Tulsa, and they happened to be located on some of the richest reserves of oil in Oklahoma.
And, they owned the property that you're saying they owned property?
Yeah, they did. Mm-hmm. They did. They became entrepreneurs. That's how the name Black Wall Street happened. By 1921, I mean, white resentment was seething over this. And so I love this quote because it might register with your viewers. There was a frenzy among white settlers to get the oil from the people, to take it away from them. When I hear frenzy of white settlers, I'm thinking about what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza. But at any rate, there are other parallels as well, because so eventually there was a pretext. There was a lie that a black man had sexually assaulted a white woman in an elevator, and that triggered the massive attacks on that Greenwood area of Tulsa, which is known as Black Wall Street. And they destroyed hundreds of business. Well, 100 people were killed. Hundreds of businesses were just completely wiped out and destroyed. And I found also that right next to this area was the Osage Reservation, the indigenous people. And they had ended up living there. They had migrated there. They were pushed into Oklahoma. Again, you have massive relocation of people. Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
What Trump's trying to do in Gaza. And the leader wanted it to be turned into a state. He wanted an Indian state in the Osage territory, and it never came to be. He tried to negotiate with the government. They wouldn't allow it. So you see, this is history coming full circle. And just one other comment, why you don't hear much about oil is because it's the fuel of the military. That's why it's so essential. Germany lost 2 world wars because its military machine literally ran out of gas. And so every world power ever since then knows this, and that's why there is this mad scramble, the great game for oil, because you want to make sure you get yours and keep the other guys away from it. And in a way, that was what my father was trained to do as head of counterintelligence, and he was spying on our allies of all people. Mm-hmm. You know, right after World War II, who was he spying on? He was spying on the Russians, the British, the French, and wanting to make sure he wrote in a document. His marching orders: we must control the oil at all costs. And at that time, it was Saudi oil, and Saudi oil is still king. This is why you saw Mohammed bin Salman just coming to the United States, mm-hmm. and being paraded around by Trump, even though he was responsible for the killing of an opposition figure who was also a Washington Post reporter, Khashoggi. And I mean, this is, the outrages continue every week. I'm thinking that it's finally catching up.
Mm. And, well, you know, this fact that you've introduced that Black Wall Street was basically fueled, pardon the pun, by oil that blacks had, then, you know, I don't think many people are aware of that. How much oil was actually flowing through Oklahoma to earn it the title of the oil capital of the world? Do you know?
I can't tell you. I can't tell you, but it was, I mean, it was, this is the early days, mm-hmm. of the oil industry. And they could all see that it was going to be used for fuel. And so, you know, huge profits are to be made. And it wasn't just oil that Black Wall Street developed. I mean, they had banks, they had businesses in the area and so on. I mean, it's interesting because Arafat, who was the leader of the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, when he heard that there was going to be oil off the coast of Gaza and that the Gazans had the right to exploit it, he said, "Oh, thank God, we finally have the chance to develop our own economy and not be reliant on either Israel or any other power in the region." So mm-hmm. we saw this as a great blessing. But what Netanyahu did is he prevented them from having it. So, you know, that's how you have to deal with it. When people have been deprived for so long, you can't blame them for thinking, "Oh my God, finally we're going to get some oil revenues in here, mm-hmm. we're going to improve our standard of living." Now we're at a stage where we found out, thanks to the lies of the oil companies about the dangers of fossil fuel emissions, now we see how really problematic it is, both mm-hmm. for the environment.
Yes. So in the 2 minutes that we have left, Charlotte, were blacks and the Osage Native Americans ever able to recoup their wealth after the massacre? Do you know?
Sorry, I didn't hear. Could you repeat your question?
Were blacks and the Osage tribe, were they ever able to recoup some of their wealth after the massacre?
I think that I do not think so. The Osage was written about in a book, Killers of the Flower Moon, which became a movie even. And the families of the Osage, they were eliminated. They were murdered. Mm. I mean, yeah, no, it never fully recovered. Although now Tulsa honors those who fought back. They fought back, but I don't think that they ever succeeded in bringing back sort of the golden days of that. Yeah.
Investigative journalist, attorney, and author of Follow the Pipeline, Charlotte Dennett. She's our guest once again this morning on What's at Stake. She, of course, is the daughter of the late Daniel C. Dennett, U.S. master spy for the Middle East, who was mysteriously killed in a plane crash while on mission in Ethiopia in 1947. Thank you for joining us again this morning, Attorney Charlotte Dennett.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Verna.
And your other book, Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon, Nelson, Rockefeller, and Evangelism. Is that the end of the title? Or does
In the
it go
Age
on?
Of Oil.
Okay. Up next, a child is a child is a child. And at what age should he or she be sentenced as an adult? 44 states and the District of Columbia have changed their laws, and the results will amaze you. We'll be back in a moment with the author of In Our Future, We Are Free, Nell Bernstein.
Peace! This is your social justice calendar for the week of Monday, December 1st, 2025. Starting on November 28th, participants have started walking 103 miles over 12 days until they reach the SCI Mahanoy Corrections Facility in Frackville on December 9th to fight for retrial and justice where Mumia Abu-Jamal is incarcerated. For more info, contact March for Mumia at 862-240-6589 or marchformumia at gmail.com. On Wednesday, December 3rd at 4 p.m., learn your rights and options for unhealthy housing conditions and evictions and get support with any next steps virtually on Zoom. Register at empowerdc.org/events. On Friday, December 5th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, there will be a book event, Enemy of the Sun, presenting poetry of Palestinian resistance on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. On Sunday, December 7th, Siddiqui Educational Safari hosts Next Generation Jam to support their efforts to organize teens on how to resist labor abuses and take 10 teens to Palenque de San Basilio, Colombia in 2026 to study Maroon culture. Cafe St. X at 14th and T Street Northwest from 5 to 8 p.m. For tickets, text 202-361-0501. No tickets at the door. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back. You're listening to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, if you've been secretly worried about, unsettled by, or just curious as to how children can be tried as adults in some instances and not in others, then you need to hear the findings of Nell Bernstein's book, In Our Future, We Are Free. The independent and collective hard work of mothers, activists, litigators, and journalists have led to the dismantling of the youth prison system across America. And Nell Bernstein is the winner of the American Bar Association Silver Gavel Award, and she was named the White House Champion of Change. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Salon, and Mother Jones publications. Nell Bernstein has appeared on NPR, The Tavis Smiley Show, among others, and she's joining us this morning on What's at Stake. Good morning, Nell Bernstein.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Now, your book is about the number of prisons designed to incarcerate youths are disappearing across America and the practice of charging children as adults, and I'm saying depending on the heinousness of the crimes they commit, that practice is actually dying. So describe the legal landscape as it pertains to youth prisons. How many were there? How many have shuttered in the last 20 years? And how many remain open?
Yeah, so we're talking about a couple of seismic changes. The number of young people incarcerated in this country, period, has dropped by 75% since 2000. The number of youth prisons has dropped by at least 2/3. And I think, you know, equally surprisingly, the number of kids prosecuted as adults has dropped by 80%. So that you know, that's, if you had told me 10 years ago that I'd be coming bearing good news, I would have scoffed, but it actually is the result of a very powerful and successful movement.
And we're going to talk about that movement for sure. But some juveniles who commit violent and heinous crimes, such as murders, are the ones who usually get sentenced as adults. So if youth prisons are being shuttered, what is happening to those violent youth?
So it's interesting that you say that. That's what everyone thinks. But we're seeing some backlash around adult transfer in DC in particular. Before the shutdown, the House passed a piece of legislation lowering the age at which children can be tried as adults from 16 to 14, and the list of offenses, for lack of a better word, that they can be charged as adults for includes things like aggravated burglary. So even our most extreme punishment is not reserved for the most extreme crimes. But to answer your larger question, well, just to be clear, when I say youth prison, I am talking about, state-run facilities for teenagers. I call them youth prisons because if you've ever been inside one, that's what they are. But people probably know them under all kinds of names: academies, boys' schools, ranches, etc.
Oh, I see. So that does include those types of facilities that are not named as, facilities for holding
Exactly.
children that
Yeah.
have been accused of crimes and convicted of
Yeah.
crimes.
The
I see.
euphemisms are just insane, and so I just don't use them anymore. And honestly, I wrote a book in 2014 called Burning Down the House that is a close examination of what these places are like. The subtitle then was The End of Juvenile Prison. I don't use the word juvenile anymore either because I looked at my own teenagers and thought, well, I would never call them that. That's kind of what you call a young animal. So I
Well,
think.
what age group are we talking about? Because teenagers, I mean, you have to be 21 in order to drink in this country, and you have to be, you ha you well, let me see. I have a whole list of things
I think I take the point that you're making.
that, what age group are we talking about when we talk?
So that's actually more complicated than you would think. In most places, 18 is the oldest you can be to be tried in family court or juvenile court or whatever a particular state
Because you
calls
have to
it.
be 18 to serve in the military. And you have to be 18 to vote
Right.
and 21 to drink, but
The
only
other
16 to get a driver's license. So you're saying 18. So what's the legal age of childhood in America? That's the
well,
question.
depends on who you are, but the other thing is that a lot of states don't have a minimum age for juvenile court jurisdiction. So that's another place where there is both advocacy and pushback. In some states, a child as young as 8 can be tried as in juvenile court.
In juvenile court, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you see kids being hauled out of their schools in handcuffs even younger than that. I think we really haven't decided what childhood is, and the question of who is a child, which is the title of my chapter on adult transfer, is a highly racialized question. A 14-year-old white kid is much more likely to be kept in the juvenile system than a 14-year-old black kid. So I think what I've come to believe is that childhood is a status that is reserved for some kids and denied to others.
Wow. Now, I don't know if we ever got an answer to the question of what's happening to the violent youth if these places are being shuttered.
Yeah, so it really varies from state to state, and I think it's something that the states are struggling with. The fear was that if we closed the youth prisons, judges would want a harsher response than what was available, and so more kids would get transferred to adult court. As I said, that hasn't happened. We've actually seen an 80% drop in the number of kids who are transferred. Nevertheless, that remains an option, and we still are sending kids into the adult prison system. In California, where I live, we recently closed our entire state-run youth prison system with promises that we would create home-like, therapeutic, culturally sensitive, blah blah alternatives. We didn't do that. So here in California, if you're convicted of something serious, you end up in what is euphemistically called a secure youth treatment facility, which is actually just a wing of county juvenile hall. It really varies. In New York State, they've created something called the Close to Home program, which keeps the majority of New York City youth in the five boroughs. The most secure facility that they have is basically a brownstone that locks. So that really varies from state to state. But what to do with young people who commit serious and violent crimes, it's a really important question and one that I struggle with. But youth crime has also dropped by 75% since 2000. Mm-hmm. And that includes these serious offenses. So it's just not the issue that we're made to believe that it is.
Well, okay. So tell us about the case of Christopher Simmons, a 17-year-old who was sentenced to death. Tell us about that case.
So his case is important because it was the beginning of a series of Supreme Court lawsuits that limited the practice of adult transfer.
Tell us what he actually did, why he was sentenced to death.
That he and a friend, as I remember, because there were several Supreme Court cases, broke into a woman's house. And when they didn't really find anything, they kidnapped her and threw her off of a bridge. So it was a horrific crime. And he was sentenced to death. It got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court looked at a growing body of research showing that the adolescent brain is just very much in flux. The current thinking is that it's not fully developed until age 25. So that means not only that are young people more likely to do things without understanding the consequences, it also means that they're more amenable to rehabilitation and change. So the court decided that you couldn't declare a child so permanently irredeemable that you could literally execute them. And mm-hmm. from that case, a series of further cases flowed that first outlawed mandatory juvenile life without parole, then made that retroactive and opened the door to dialing back the whole notion that you can try a child as an adult. Because although obviously his offense was horrific and requires a serious response, this notion that you can try some children, not all children, as adults, it's just cognitively nonsensical. I can't eat an apple as an orange. So the court did pave the way for an understanding that, as you said at the beginning, a child is a child is a child, and that childhood doesn't magically get erased when that child does something truly horrific.
Mm. So the prosecutors in Simmons' case argued that he was a bad seed. The fact that they kidnapped the woman and threw her over the bridge, and the fact that he was 17 was all the more reason that he should be put to death before he could commit other more heinous crimes. But the defense, as you said, countered that Simmons was, like all teenagers, operating with a half-formed brain. And the full breadth of the defense argument was compelling enough to have the court decide in their favor. They said juveniles' brains are still developing. Teenagers seek risk. They engage in impulsive behavior and less likely to consider consequences. 3/4 of American boys break the law before they reach adulthood. Teenagers age out at the risk-taking years. That was interesting. That was an interesting fact. And one neuropsychologist said, like driving a car with sensitive gas pedal and bad brakes. So they won that case, did they not?
Now you can't execute children anymore.
Mm-hmm. So was he released, or what happened to him after that, after the Supreme Court said that, you can't sentence children to death?
So I don't think he was. but I can't say that for sure. These cases were very narrow. They didn't say you have to release all minors when they turn 25. We still have the option of sentencing young people to very, very, very long sentences. And I actually just published a piece in The Imprint a couple of weeks ago that allowed me to interview men, adult men, who had been sentenced to life without parole for things they did as teenagers. And these guys did serve 20 or 30 years before they were allowed to go before a court and be resentenced under these new Supreme Court laws. I can't really convey the depth of responsibility that they came to take for their childhood actions. There's a man named Gani Songster who is just such a profound thinker who said, "I created a tear in the fabric of life when I killed someone. I'm not going to be able to mend that tear," but he has committed the rest of his life to community violence prevention and restorative justice work. So I think the kind of fundamental takeaway from these Supreme Court decisions and the developmental psychology and neuroscience that led to them is people change, especially teenagers, and we can't have options that foreclose that possibility.
And some of these facilities, or whatever you want to call them, prisons for youth, are just horrific places. Do you happen to have your book handy?
That is an excellent question.
Well, I have it if you don't.
Okay. No, I see it. I'm going to grab it.
Okay. On page 96, there is a description of the Oak Hill juvenile
Right.
facility in Washington, D.C., page 96.
Okay.
Midway through, it says Oak Hill had been under court supervision. Can you read those two paragraphs to the end of that page and the next?
Sure. Starting where?
Oak Hill had been under court supervision for well over a decade.
Okay. You know what? I think you have the galleys, and I have the.
I have the actual hardback,
Okay.
page 96.
So I am looking at it and not seeing that particular paragraph.
Okay, I'll read it. Oak Hill
Okay.
had been under court supervision for well over a decade, with nightmarish accounts emerging from the facility on a regular basis. Children as young as 8, some accused of nothing more than running away from home, were being held in filthy, darkened cells inside the crumbling building. They washed their clothes in buckets, showered with cold water, and dried themselves with the sheets from their bunks inside a facility that didn't provide hot water, soap, or even enough to eat. The cell blocks were either scorching hot or freezing cold, depending on the vagrancies of a poorly maintained boiler. With no one assigned to manage pest control or even clean the facility, the place was infested with swarms of cockroaches. Court monitors found snakes in children's beds. A building inspector told the Washington Post that he was surprised that the place had not been condemned. On top of the inhuman conditions, a brutal culture of abuse had long reigned at Oak Hill. This is a facility in Washington, D.C. A 1989 investigation found that guards routinely assaulted children with bricks, knives, chairs, and closed fists in attacks that were organized and premeditated. The beatings left children with broken teeth, swollen eyes, and internal injuries. The level of impunity was such that one guard bragged to a Washington Post reporter about how hard he had hit a teenager he had caught drinking during a football game. Quote, "That was the first time I was able to knock a boy damn near out with his helmet on. I felt wonderful," end quote, he told the newspaper, providing his full name and attribution. So those are the kind of conditions, and this is in your book, that you write about, that the children were actually facing at Oak Hill. And you also talk about how there was a whole culture of resistance to reform there by the guards and others that worked there. While there were some people that were assisting with the reform, there were some that were resisting. Is that not true?
Yeah, and you know, as you read that, I want to say things have gotten, well, I want to say two things. Oak Hill was not exceptional in that way. That was happening across the country. It just happens that a guy named Vinnie Schiraldi took over the system in Washington, D.C. and decided to close the place down. The other thing is, I see headlines like that every day right now. We have a much smaller number of these institutions, but we really have not made much progress on conditions. You know, here in California, we just had, I think, 50 guards indicted for starting gladiator fights among the kids. Children die in these places on a regular basis. So even though that sounds like some historical horror, it is happening to this day, just to a smaller number of kids.
Wow. But now you write that 44 states, including the District of Columbia, have passed laws making it more difficult to try young people as adults or to incarcerate them alongside adults. Those results are pretty stunning that you articulated at the top of the segment. Who are the people who led this fight and what strategies did they use?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that. I just want to say for your DC listeners that unfortunately, DC is the heart of the backlash right now. I think I mentioned that it undid some of those reforms a couple of months ago. So, you know, the book is a portrait of a movement, and a movement takes all kinds of people using all kinds of strategies in all kinds of places. And that's especially true when it comes to criminal justice, because that's controlled at the state and local level. That said, I think the first and most powerful actors in this movement were young people themselves and their parents, who starting in the early 1990s, you know, essentially a prison depends on invisibility in order to function. There's a reason we put these places in the middle of nowhere. The bars and walls and razor wire that keep some people inside of them keep the rest of us out. It's very hard to get in as a reporter. Family members are kept in tightly controlled visiting areas. So I think that the kind of spark of the movement came when young people who were inside these places or had been inside these places started fighting just to make the kind of thing that you just read known. And as they did that, their mothers and fathers and grandparents were marching in the streets, visiting legislators, writing letters, conducting dramatic street actions, again, just to make their children's suffering visible. And also, I think the other thing that incarceration of children depends on is a racialized dehumanization. And so what the mothers and fathers and the children themselves were doing is just saying, these are children, these are my children. One of the most powerful chants of the early years that is used to this day in Louisiana, you know, parents will do a call and response that simply says, whose kids are kids? Whose kids are kids? Which in Louisiana, where they sent a bunch of Black children to an abandoned death row at the Angola State Penitentiary a couple of years ago, which is a former slave plantation where incarcerated men still work the fields under the watch of armed guards. These parents were saying, yeah, I think that they were quite consciously evoking slavery when they said, whose kids are kids? So that was really, I think, the origin of the movement. You had incredible civil rights lawyers, all kinds of advocates, people like Vinnie Schiraldi in D.C., closing places from the inside, all kinds of actors.
Mm-hmm. Well, wow, very impressive work that they did. And you said also that the youth themselves did it. But now I want to thank you. Go ahead, real fast. We have about 60 seconds left. Did you want to make a comment now?
No. I mean, sure, I could talk for another hour.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us this morning on What's at Stake. Of course, that's Nell Bernstein, the winner of the American Bar Association Silver Gavel Award, and she was named the White House Champion of Change. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Salon, and Mother Jones publications, and she has appeared on NPR, The Tavis Smiley Show, and, of course, this morning on What's at Stake. So that's going to do it for this week's What's at Stake. Thank you all for listening, and thank to our engineer, our multi-talented program director, Katia Stitt. Next week, Kimon Freeman will be your host, discussing, among other things, the continued criminalization of D.C. youth and scrutinizing of the curfew that has been imposed. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Ife Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done.
That is hanging up the goddamn nation. Looks like we always end up in a rut. Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what? Come on, baby.
Hey, y'all. I am Jaren with Dreaming Out Loud.
And I'm Ron Motes with the Go-Go Museum and Cafe. This holiday season, Historic Anacostia is bringing joy from December the 11th through the 22nd.
A celebration filled with daily surprises along Marion Barry and MLK Jr. Avenue Southeast. Christmas tree lighting, live concerts at the Go-Go Museum, and holiday meals and deals from your favorite Anacostia businesses.
12 days of festive family fun as you dine, shop, and explore D.C.'s Arts and Culture District. Powered by the Anacostia Bid, artsagogo.org. For more information.
If you're a dancer or just a fan, the Way You Move Festival is coming to Washington, D.C. with jams, competitions, and classes. December 13th through the 16th. Whether you're into hip-hop, house, breaking, popping, or locking, we've got you covered with top-notch Small Fries Edition, all-styles dance jam and competition for youth ages 17 and under on the 13th at Edgewood Arts Center. Freshest of all time, 2-verse-2 breaking battle, ages 18 and up, also on the 13th at the Black Cat. The world-famous Juice Debut 2-verse-2 competition, DC Prelims, on the 14th at The Reach. And masterclasses with international Juice Debut judges on the 15th and 16th. All in Washington, D.C., all family-friendly, December 13th through 16th. Additional event and registration information at wblinc.org/The Way You Move. Brought to you by the Words, Beats, and Life nonprofit.
And lots of great things happening in the DMV. Good morning. This is WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. We thank everyone that gave yesterday during Giving Tuesday. There's still time. There's still time. The website, WPFW, FM.org. is a way that you can still make a contribution for Giving Tuesday. And up next, in literally seconds, is newly installed or enthroned Dr. Ife Williams. I'm sure she'll tell us all about that on Wake Up and Stay Woke. You're in tune to WPFW Washington.